too. I've written a lot of stuff. You know, I got all sorts of manuscripts and junk, but then I like to keep them hid, you know, because I've got this aversion to giving lectures, but I enjoy immensely listening to them. I guess it has something to do with the quotes, style, close quotes, of the black preacher. They are a lot less lecturers in the traditional understanding of what a lecturer is, and more of a preacher. And even when they've got manuscripts in front of them, you know, they find themselves, you know, preaching. So I may be preaching more than I'm lecturing, basically because what I'm going to talk about this morning is really not so much a lecture as it is a sermon, or what I call a presenting of the gospel. The gospel, not of Christ or anything like this, but the presentation of the gospel, Jesus. When the tribes of Israel gathered around the campfires to reminisce and to dream, they told a story. And it's sort of exciting, you know, how they pretty much stuck to the one story. It was the story of Abraham. Now the Lord said to Abraham, "Get out of your country and from your father's house and from your land, and I'll to a land that I'll show you." Genesis 12:1. And then Abraham went out without knowing where he was going, for he looked for a city which had a foundation, whose builder and maker was God. And Abraham went out without knowing where he was going. Now, I think that's probably describes adequately the plight of the lecturer this morning. But don't accept that as an unalterable truth, because I think that could be a put on. I do know where I'm going. This quotation from the Old Testament story in Genesis is familiar to all of us, I think. And Abraham is in a city called Ur of Chaldees, and he's engaged in some sort of business, no doubt, perhaps with his father. And the familiar surroundings of this ancient city didn't really prevent Abraham from becoming consumed by this new and strange idea to take off and to try and discover what was. How far is it from Holden to the Ur of Chaldees? I guess is, you know, the question that we ought to be asking. We're amid, I guess, familiar surroundings for most of us, unfamiliar to some. And how some of us may, before this is over, become quite consumed by a new and a strange idea. I recall this story, and not just to emphasize one man's discontent with where he was, but to emphasize our collective call to a new adventure. The new Abrahams may be named Malcolm, or Martin, or Stokely, or Rapp, or Eldridge, or Rosemary, or Marty, or Witt, or any of the folks that some of us are familiar with, more familiar with some than we are with others. And I called some of the names of people who are here because that's sort of the way I see them. These are the new Abrahams, whom I believe have sort of deserted the comfort of certainty and the security of the traditional for the discomfort, really, of the ambiguity and the uncertainty of change. And while some people think that, you know, well, you know, these embryonic overloads are just releasing all of this stuff just to show something. I don't know what, you know, I would suppose that there are as many attitudes that would develop, you know, when subjected to new stuff like this as there are people in the room. But while I'm not trying to make an apology or even make more palatable the stuff that is said, I am trying to somehow help us to get inside of an individual who is possessed by a spirit that yearns to breathe free and at the same time yearns to give assent to its humanness in its context, that context being either a context of new, innovative, strange women theologians or black folks who now talk about Jesus not just as though Jesus is the quote savior, but they talk about Jesus as he is, and so I talk about him as my brother because that's what he is. A sort of radical understanding of the relationship of Christ to black people and black power, I think, begins with the concept of freedom. Freedom stands at the center of the black man's yearning in the United States and in the world. Freedom now has been and still is the reverberating cry of black people. However, freedom now is not just expressed in cliches, and Brother Martin was good at cliches, but, you know, he got through with them all the time, you know. We used to always laugh, you know, hear him once, you've heard him, you know, every time. And he could talk about freedom. He could preach about freedom. And I think that Brother Martin created the climate for this word freedom to be translated into other words, which meant exactly the same thing, and you heard this morning. Self-determination, self-identity, black power, and we could go on and on with them. I guess we should try to define this freedom for which we've marched and died, many of us. Freedom is not so much doing what I want to do. You know, the expression, you know, doing your own thang, T-H-A-N-G, doesn't really adequately describe the freedom that we're talking about here. Freedom, very simply, is, I think, becoming what I should, being what I am, moving against that which oppresses and destroys me, both physically and psychologically. You heard a little bit this morning, and I don't want to go through that again. I plan to do a little bit on the it-thou thing, but I think Rosemary cleared that up for us, you know, and for those of you who did not hear that, you know, crawl off into a corner with her, because I think that she has captured pretty much the whole posture of black folks and other folks who have been relegated to some partial thing, some thing called it, as opposed to thou, I, and other words which express humanist life. Well, we got to start with a question. Now, why did God go through all the trouble, you know, to die and to do all of the other things that we're not going to bother to trot out here? Four Gospels, I suppose, are replete with them, as is the entire chronicle of God's activity called the Old Testament. What was the reasoning behind all of this? Galatians 5:1, I think, says it. For freedom, Christ has set us free. And as long as black folks are slaves, to another power. He is wholly incapable of understanding. That statement and other statements that Jesus made about freedom. He's not free to serve God with the, quote, mature responsibility. He's not free to become what he is, human. Different from being an animal and different from being a plant. And so black power means people carrying out their own history, their own identity. Black people giving assent to the presence of God in his son, Jesus, in their context. Black power then is redemptive, and it is the visible topography of what Jesus is. It is not like Christianity. It is not similar to Christianity or Christ. It is Jesus. And so Jesus is with the oppressed, lives with them, eats with them, talks with them, drinks with them, and he is the general, if you will, who develops the ideology and the style for doing battle against the demonic, the evil one, the oppressor. We know who the evil one is. We know where he is, and we know how he operates. Now, the reason we know is that we have been watching the cat for a number of years. See, we have had to study him in order to survive. You see, we know all of his habits, and we know when he's coming to get us, and we even know how he's going to get us. We're able to not only second guess, but, you know, I mean, take it to the nth degree. It's a miraculous thing, you know, how some of the brothers, even more than myself, can sniff out the evil one miles and miles and miles away. So Malcolm X, that is, was correct when he identified the devil for what he is. And so we resurrect one awful truth about the devil. He is not red, and he is not black. Well, pick color, y'all. He created things called ghettos. And he murdered and filled the rivers of Mississippi and Alabama, Pearl Rivers, one river that comes to my mind right now, clay banks and stuff with the bodies of people whose life he snuffed out. Because he just couldn't deal with with the presentation of the gospel. He could not deal with the revelation of Jesus, where he is and where he has always been. So Jesus moved in on this world to destroy the works of the devil. And to destroy the devil, not only his work, but destroy him. And that's what Jesus is all about. Unfortunately, my Christianity came to me from white people, oppressors, who in their quote, revealing of Jesus to me, attach certain demands to those revelations. And it was, and the demands went something like this, that I had to reject my concern for my people. I had to become concerned about something other than the folk. And I had to reject my blackness. I had to affirm the next world, heaven. And I had to affirm whiteness. Let me just show how some of this happened. I remember my grandmother joined the Lutheran Church, and she was taken in to the Lutheran Church in 1919. My father was taken in 1925. And I've got a copy of a musty old thing called the Colored Lutheran that I plow through when I need inspiration. It shows, you know, the dates and things and stuff, confirmations and baptisms and what have you. And after every one of these things, my folks got little certificates, as did I, which had a verse on there that says, "Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest, that he would send forth laborers to the harvest." And then picture, and then another statement, "The fields are white for the harvest." Well, that told me something then, and it tells me a little, even more now. So very early I became suspicious of the white Jesus. I didn't quite know whether or not he was for real or not. Whether or not somehow the contradictions were doing more than suggesting to me that this person was something other than the savior of the world and the one who had achieved the ultimate in identifying with, quotes, lost and fallen humanity. A young man from Ghana visited my town when I was a parish pastor. And he was Lutheran. He looked in the yellow pages to find a Lutheran church. And of course, some of us could not afford the advertisement, so he didn't see ours, but he did see a Lutheran church. And so he went to this church to worship. Now, he was dressed in American clothing, and he looked very much like an American black man. And he found himself being blocked by the ushers of the church. And he did not understand this, and he went through explanations and things about how he was Lutheran and how he wanted to worship and things like this. And so they said, "There's a church across town where you can worship. The man's name is Pastor Hertzfeld." "Well, what's yours?" "Well, I'm not going to call the guy's name now, but he gave his name." He says, "It's very similar, you know, strange, you know. Why, you know, I can't make it across town on, you know, and be there for the worship hour, you know. Why can't I worship here?" Well, finally they got fed up with it and they called the police, and the young man was carted away, see, and locked up for disturbing the peace. Well, then somebody called me and said, we had to arrest a nigger who wanted to come to church. Can you come and talk to him?" And so I went to the jail, and I think for the first time in my life I cried for more than 3 days. I'll cut all the conversation and just say, just give one little sentence. "Will, you know, for almost 18 years, I have been serving and worshiping an inferior Jesus. a Jesus that I could worship in Ghana, and a Jesus who apparently was in Ghana, but apparently there's a better Jesus over here. Well, I don't, quite frankly, don't give a damn whether he's a better Jesus or not. I reject him. I reject you. I reject everything that he stands for. And I'll go back and I'll try and see if it's possible for me to work with my inferior Jesus. Well, that's it, folks. That's where we are. Jesus, the man, brothers, whose sole purpose it was to remove the chains of slavery. Isaiah 61, Luke 4, 18 and 19. He became a slave. He identified with the lowest, the most despicable life forms, short of the animal. Why? To do what we have just said, of course. Now, why does a black preacher want to know more about this Jesus? Well, I think that the black preacher now has started to understand, and certainly, well, when I say black preacher, I'll use the word black preacher and theologians interchangeably here, because I think that they both mean pretty much the same thing. I think that Jesus, as far as we are concerned at this point, speaks and acts with us. We are the oppressed people. And so we find now that if we want to pursue the historical Jesus for about 10 seconds, if Jesus elected to become a Jew so many hundreds of years ago, then there is very little doubt as to what he is now. What color he is, where he lives, what his professions or non-professions are. To answer last night's question, and I just want to answer that briefly, and then I'm going to turn to the master here and read some things for you, because I think he says it a little better than I do, about whether or not third world people are believers, you know, whether they are Christians or not. Well, it is not my understanding that all third world people are Christians. It is, however, my understanding that Christ is with them. For those of you who have not seen this, check it out and deal with it. Don't try and do it alone. You know, get some help, preferably someone who is a theologian. I don't know how much money you got. Fly Mary, Rosemary from Washington, she'll help you deal with it. I think that she understands what we're going to say here. I want to do this, and then I want to talk, you know, a bit with you. James Cohen, Black Theology and Black Power. I'm reading from page 150. For white people, God's reconciliation in Jesus Christ means that God has made black people a beautiful people. And if they are going to be in relationship with God, they must enter by means of their black brothers, who are a manifestation of God's presence on earth. The assumption that one can know God without knowing blackness is the basic heresy of white churches. They want God without blackness. They want God without blackness. Christ without obedience. and love without death. What they fail to realize is that in America, God's revelation on earth has always been black, red, or some other shocking shade, but never white. Whiteness, as revealed in the history of America, is the expression of what is wrong with man. It is a symbol of man's depravity. God cannot be white, even though white churches have portrayed him as white. When we look at what whiteness has done to the minds of men in this country, we can see clearly what the New Testament meant when it spoke of the principalities and powers. To speak of Satan and his powers becomes not just a way of speaking, but a fact of reality. When we see a people who are being controlled by an ideology of whiteness, then we know what reconciliation must mean. The coming of Christ means a denial of what we thought we were. It means destroying the white devil in us. Reconciliation to God means that white people are prepared to deny themselves. Whiteness, take up the cross, blackness, and follow Christ. Black ghetto. And Jim adds, to be sure this is not easy, but whoever said the gospel of Christ was easy? Obedience always means going where we otherwise would not go, being what we would not be, doing what we would not do. And reconciliation means that Christ has freed us for this in a white, racist society. Christian obedience can only mean being obedient to blackness, its glorification, and its exaltation. Now, please understand that, you know, most of us black preachers and theologians alike, as I indicated last night, don't always come too clear on the whole business of blackness and whiteness, so I want to repeat that again in one simple sentence so that you can understand it. We are talking about blackness and whiteness as states of the mind as opposed to skin color. You see. And I want to make sure that you understand that so that you understand what we say here when we say that Jesus is not white, and any religion that portrays him as white or thinks he's white, any church that has a white picture hanging in its hall of Jesus, is not the church of Jesus. It is not the servant of Jesus. It is the servant of the Antichrist. Now, I think that may be enough right now, you know, for us to sort of sink our teeth into and you know, and dialogue a little bit, right?
Well, you know, one of the most striking things I ever heard, I can't remember where I got this now, I think I read it just in the newspaper, but it was, and as I remember it, it was some preacher or somebody down in Watts, and I don't... preaching about Jesus, and some guy in the crowd stood up and said, and this is only the part I really remember clearly, he said, "What the hell do I care if somebody rose from the dead on Easter Sunday out of the grave if he's just going to be another white man to kick me?" In other words, anybody who rose from the grave and didn't rise black would be just another demon.
That's right.
Would not be a risen Lord.
That's right. You see, and what we have to deal with here now, I think you are right, absolutely, you know, and he's right, I should say.
That really struck me.
Yeah. We've got to deal with some screwed up color schemes in this society, even from the Bible itself, you see. I like to pick on that Song of Solomon passage because it's such a little gem, you know. She is black but comely. Now, you don't have to subject the word comely to any varying degrees of color test to understand that it means beautiful. What meaneth this but? You know what blackness is. Those of us who had a chance to look at Hebrew, you know, understand now, finally, that the word is translated more often and than but, you see? So what the way the passage should read, she is black and beautiful, you know? And that's it. So we gotta redo all this stuff, all the foul up color schemes, and make it what it is. You see, you know, black and white confrontations is, you know, it's not new in the Bible. Take Miriam, for example. It's kind of interesting, you know, Martin was always pictured as the 20th century Moses, and he was. However, you know, he forgot, you know, how he came to a point where he had to lead the folks to the promised land. What he saw was an Egyptian pig beating his people. And he did not demonstrate in front of Pharaoh's court at first, nor did he form a resolution or a petition. You see, he looked this way and that, and he did the Egyptian pig in. You see, and this was the beginning of the Exodus, you see. This is the beginning. But you see, you know, all this is a chain of events, you know, that it gets Moses into trouble, but then he takes out, what's the name of that country? I forget. Yeah, right. And he meets this black woman, you know, and he falls in love with her, and he marries her. And his sister got kind of uptight about that. You know, how dare you marry a black woman, you know. And so Moses apparently checked out with the Lord whether he was doing what was right or not. And the Lord says, okay, Moses, I think I shall show your sister what whiteness is. And so he afflicted her with the worst case of leprosy that, you know, that at least this is what the Bible says, it's been seen, you know. And, you know, all of these things, you know, are sort of creeping into our thing here to sort of show, you know, that white does not connote righteousness and justice and purity and love and cleanliness and all of the other things that whiteness portray. And one of the tragedies, of the Lutheran Church, for example, is that when we dissect or do something with the Luther Rose, you know, whiteness always comes through and it does irreparable damage to the minds of our little children. You know, when the black part of the rose is depicted as something, you know, bad and evil and ugly, and the white part is always the good parts, you see. The incredibility of church conventions, you know, girls in white hats, you know, and Miss Nebraska's and Miss Iowa's, you know, kissing the president, you know, and doing all of these weird things, you know, to somehow convince folks, you know, that white is so beautiful and so right. If you're white, you're right, and if you're black, get back. That's, you know, that's something that we've been living with for centuries, you see. Now it's time we straighten out this screwed up color system and talk about the goodness and the beauty of blackness. As we understand Jesus, all right?
Does thinking black, do you think in terms of color?
I think so to a certain extent. You know, I don't want to get off of blackness, you know, but I think in terms of the oppressor and the oppressed, you see? And that's a black and white situation.
Right now.
Right now. What do you mean by right now? Before I agree with you too quickly.
What I meant was that it's not all black and white. In other words, that oppressors can be on either side of the color barrier.
Well, we haven't had our chance yet. You see, and you see, we've thought about this. Those of us who are Christian and who understand Jesus, if that should be the case, you know, then we are with Jesus. Wherever Jesus is, that's where we are. Jesus is always with the oppressed people and never with the oppressor. So don't get hung up on that, you know, if you're with Jesus.
Willie, did you see the Gospel According to St. Matthew?
The
that,
film?
That film?
Yeah,
that
sure.
I couldn't stand the Jesus. He really drove me crazy. But the one thing that really hit me, and I never had thought of it until right now, and you brought this up, was the fact that that little scummy court and how little and unimportant it was and how very much it was a, it was not, you know, it was of no importance. And it's exactly what you're saying now, that this is where, I mean, this is where Jesus appeared, you know, at the time when the Jews were really, you know, they were the offscouring. I don't care how we build up the colors of the temple. That picture, that's one thing that picture did. I think you've got.
It's also Marxist, though. I mean, so again, Jesus was identified with the working
I'm glad
people,
you did that.
You know,
yeah.
So, which is also the other another oppressed community.
Well, good thing about that.
George Wallace, you know, had a nightmare one night, and he woke up in a cold sweat. And he was practically climbing the walls, and one of his aides says, "What's wrong, George?" And George said, "My God, she's colored." Women sort of, you know, not sort of, they do. They enjoy the privilege of being a part of the oppressed community too, you see. What you do is, you know, is identify oppression, and of course, I sort of carry one portfolio here, but as I said before, I think that this opens up the doors, you know, and gets us into the center of the thing, you see. And every one of those doors is a black man. We were talking earlier this morning, you know, and black folks still enjoy the privilege of opening and closing doors, except now nobody tells them when to open it and when to close it. They do it when they damn well please and how, you know, and that's the beauty of it. And that is the redemptiveness of the black lifestyle now. And right now it's trying feverishly to Christianize Christianity before it paganizes the world.
You know, teaching at a black seminary, you know, we're right now trying to throw off the effects of white acculturation, you know, the way in which that has you know, emasculated the natural religious style, and it, you know, permeates the whole place because there was such an effort to, you know, assimilate into this in order to kind of get yourself accredited and so forth, you know, and the music, I mean, you should see that chapel, it's all white. It's, you know, it's just really bad, and it's really quite a cultural struggle to throw off all of the effects, you know. So that's the thing that you become very aware of, and not merely the way in which, you know, this thing is coming on from the white man, but the way in which, you know, that has distorted the people themselves and made it so hard for them to discover themselves. I remember I was in a church in Bogalusa when the Deacons for Defense were gathering. Well, they were patrolling the community every night, you know, and this was an area in which it was sort of all the white people were sort of 200% Ku Klux Klan, you know, I mean, the entire white community was Ku Klux Klan. So they had, for those who don't know, Deacons of Defense, where they were essentially a black patrol, which just simply guarded their community and had, to a large extent, prevented these people from riding into, you know, they were agitating for wages and so forth. And this was a tremendous, the way this community was pulled together around that. And we went through a couple of days and stayed with the family of Deacons for Defense. And we went to the church that night, and I and a white doctor and a girl, Snickworth, were the only white people in the church, and we were just packed with people. And this tremendous kind of black preaching was going on, and it was really right there, secular theology, in the sense that the preaching was right connected with where the people were, and they were, in effect, saying, you know, we're going to go out tomorrow to a voter registration rally, but, you know, it was couched, it was the gospel, and it was, at the same time, the voter registration rally being announced, it was just right together. And at the end of it, the whole church was, as I said, packed, and people began to rock with this tremendous song, and I can't remember the words now, but it delivered tremendous impact of the which in effect said that the white man is the devil, you know, and it was a very strong song. And then I looked at the side of the church, and here were these huge, big figures of the apostles or something marching down, and they were all white. And I thought to myself, you know, there's, how could, you know, this tremendous, you know, black gospel is going on here, and this church is packed. How can these people stand to be in here and have these white apostles? Why don't they just throw themselves on this wall and tear it down, you know? I mean, how could they stand? You know, but they, it was sort of like it was there, but it was bypassing them. They didn't even notice it, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's been described by, at least it was described by some of the people that were on a refrigerator boat with me that used to go down to Haiti and places. You know, we went into this little museum in Haiti. Haitian art, you know, it's really fantastic. Those of you who've not seen it, look up some, you know. There's this mural of Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, you know, that covers, you know, this one wall. You know, it's all black except for one person, you know. You know, you don't need to guess who that was, you see. He was white, you see. You know, this sort of, I think, you know, gets the message through. During the Detroit riots, you know, there's this big statue in front of in front of a Catholic church that was painted black. The statue wasn't broken or destroyed or anything, just painted black, you know, and the good priest had the presence of mind to leave it that way. There's a beautiful picture of it in the January 7th last issue of Look magazine.
Film?
Yes.
In part of print in the church where the artwork is done by the people. And Christ is sitting there, Jesus, he's at a wedding, he's black, he's got a straw hat on, he's sitting in a rocking chair, and smoking cigars.
I've seen it, yeah, right, I've seen it. Yeah, sure, yeah.
Well, did I understand, you know, right when you said, when you talk about black and white, we're not thinking colors.
No, sir. We're not thinking.
People.
We're talking about a state of the mind.
We're
talking
about that, though.
No. Well, you see, you have to understand. You have to understand. You know, the complete transfer. You know, one. You know, the color is a visible manifestation of state of the mind. Now, those of you who are afflicted with a peculiar skin disease called whiteness, you know, have got to work it from another angle. You know, and we'll leave that up to you. You know, Rosemary may want to chime in on that. You know.
I think the oppressor-oppressed thing, but if you just say that as a generalization, then it's real easy to evade it. That's why I think you have to make it concrete by pointing to the particular oppressed community, which
right.
is most, you know,
which is really the thing
for your situation, and that's for us is the black community. In the 19th century, maybe it was the working class. Some other place, it may be.
Nazi Germany, strange as it may sound, it was the Jewish people. You know, I mean, you know, they somehow, I remember one said, you know, the Lord was with us.
You know, we have this phrase, sticking out like a sore thumb, you know, which refers to that big white band you found the sun, you know. And at least that was my impression. Maybe a wrong impression. I was in a Negro home a few years ago, and the woman had on a Band-Aid, and it suddenly struck me that this thing we call flesh-colored Band-Aids really looked weird.
Yeah, that's a really good example.
I laughed when we got out of there. My husband said, you know, that was really kind of risky, and I said, I don't have some funny, peculiar feelings. Why should I act unnatural?
Well, a lot of people will say, I mean, it's very typical of white people to say, but I don't have any prejudice, you know, I don't feel, you know, any different anything like that. And I use this flesh-colored bandage as an example of the fact that naturally white people don't feel they have any prejudice because they define the whole world in terms of themselves, you see, and so they're unaware of their parochialism.
You know,
unaware of your parochialism
right.
when all flesh-colored bandages are white.
Right. People are shocked when I become incensed, you know, when they define me this way. Well, you're not black. You're not white. You're a human being. You know? And I come back with, well, you know, what is this human being business synonymous with? You know, I mean, the fact that I'm a human being means that I am black. And you don't turn me out psychologically. You know, you don't. Even though you say you're not white, you know, I think that you really know that that's precisely what you are saying. You know, anytime you say you're not black, I don't see you as a black man, you know, I see you as a human being, then you're saying, whether you want to admit it or not, you know, you see me as a white man. Black folks have had a horrible time, you know, avoiding doing that with its beautiful brothers and sisters who are white. You see, you know, we started with blue-eyed soul brother, you know, and other cliches, you know, and he or she is not white. Well, now we can do that, but you can't. You have to understand, that we can do that because of what whiteness connotes. I tried to cover a little bit of that in there. That we have to tune you out white.
Well, how do you know when a person's using these terms black and white, whether or not he's referring to state of mind or to color, and does this apply throughout the Negro community now, or is this more of a black power term or other specific groups?
Well, all the time you don't. You know, I'll have to admit that. But then if you're really grooving and if you're really communicating, if you really understand, you know, Jesus, you know, if you really understand the whole oppression thing, it shouldn't be too difficult.
But suppose I hear some other black minister and he uses these terms. Can I be fairly assured that that's what he is meaning? That he's meaning the same thing by black and white that you are?
I don't know what particular concept. I don't know what's behind that question.
Well, what I'm asking is, do all black people have this interpretation of black and white when they use these terms, black and white?
Well, let's deal with, you know, one of the mysteries of blackness and black people now. You know, I think must agree that we speak pretty much with the same language. You know, it's pretty consistent. There's a different style, different approach, maybe even a different set of sentences and stuff, you know, but it means pretty much the same thing, you know. Stokely and Eldridge and Rapp, you know, were really no different from Martin, if you check it out, you know. And they would admit this. You know, they said it. In spite of all of the white press's things about the not so creative tensions in the black struggle, you know.
Well,
watch Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins, and listen real close, you know. And don't always put words in their mouths, you know, like, you know, hearing what you want to hear, because, you know, it like gives you fodder to throw, you know, to throw on black people, you know, and see if it does not in fact come out pretty much the same.
Can
you elaborate on that,
yeah.
Okay, just okay. Maybe Rosemary's going to...
Well, I was just going to say that I think, you know, from the side of white people, I think white people really have to figure out that they are being judged as white people. And that, you know, and I don't think that anything should be done to sort of let them off the dime, you know, by sort of letting this be slipping off to some kind of abstraction. That's why I'm just as happy to keep the two, the color and the meaning together. For quite a bit longer, and I'm of course very much aware of the way in which white people have been raised, including myself, encompasses them like an onion in layer upon layer upon layer of prejudices, you know. And I think you have to, you have to be constantly aware that even though you may have learned a lot, you still are to a certain extent dominated by the whole kind of society that you're raised. And
both married, there are billions of people who have been raised in all sorts of conditions among all sorts of colors, and it's pretty hard to, you know, pin that down too, isn't it?
Well, I'm talking about the way I was raised, and I spent most of you.
Don't say how I or any of us was raised.
I think I can say pretty much how you were raised.
I don't think you can.
Okay, well, I'll say it. You know, I'll say it. You know, I'm totally aware of that. You see, and I'm still, you know, pretty much convinced that you are, all of y'all are, sociologically, anthropologically, theologically, and otherwise, my enemy. All of you, you see. And I don't quite trust you yet.
But you know,
until we have reached a point where I know you individually, and I've had a chance to sniff you and touch you and feel you and test you out, you know. Until that point, you know, I don't quite trust you. And you see, of course, I plan to. What time do we end? 12? Huh?
Got 15 minutes, yeah.
I plan to talk about some, for instances, you know, I plan to do that for a few minutes now and then later on. You know, some of the proof, you know, of whether or not you are for real, you know, whether or not you are black, you know, and not white, you know, it's pretty much determined, you know, by what you do.
Mr. Hertzfeld, I'll not say anything more now, but when you talk about that you say you are a man, is that you supposed to feel that you're his enemy?
Yes.
Why?
Because you're my enemy.
Yeah, but who's you and who's I here?
White folks are my enemies.
Do white folks feel that?
Because they are white people.
Most white folks feel that you're their enemy, then?
I don't know. How many of y'all feel
it? I think a lot of them do.
You profess to be a Christian. I hope I'm a Christian. How is Jesus different to you than he is to me?
Well, you see, then we need to go into some sort of real long discussion about, you know, who you are and stuff.
See, that black man sitting in the armchair in Haiti was very real, but I grew up in a place where a painting by Gosta, a fine piece of art, represented Jesus as a shepherd, and I sort of looked at Jesus that way. And of course, maybe that's a mistake. We should never have a picture. And perhaps Finley was right, throw them all out. But we do have art in all sorts of media, I suppose in Japan, China, Jesus has different forms too. And perhaps that's a mistake we've grown up with. And it's hard to eradicate.
How many of you have pictures of white Jesus in your home right now? Now, how many of you have pictures of black Jesus in your home?
I've got a carving of Mary cut out of a heavy piece of wood. What color is it? Brown.
Would it be of any purpose to have, say, a very picture, like maybe a real redneck, to think a typical Negro looks like? Walking on a street, deserted street, dark street, toward the person who'd be looking at the picture. Have a picture like that in every white church.
This picture over here, by the way, is supposed to be a picture of Jesus.
It is.
That's white, but it's also an other Jesus. It's a hippie Jesus.
I've got a picture of a Jesus that's white in my office. It's a wanted poster, though. You know.
I have a feeling that people think, you know, why can't we just talk about to each other as humans? And that seems very feasible when we're all sitting around this fire together. But I think the real question is, you know, like, where do you live and so on? And that's where it really comes out in the wash, whether you're, you know, the enemy or not. I mean, I've said to my sister, who's, you know, with whom I'm very fond, she lives out in segregated suburbia, and I live in Black Washington, and I said to her, quite frankly, you know, when war breaks out, we're going to be on opposite sides of the barricade.
Yeah, you see, I happen to know that, you know, you belong to churches, most of you, that have, you know, allegedly taken Christ out to wherever the green grass is and the clean areas, the birds singing and low tax, you know, and all that stuff, you know. You know, I my feeling is that you didn't take him, you know, because Jesus, if he's to be with oppressed people, ain't gonna go piggyback with no bigot, you know. He just doesn't go that route.
Yeah, but he went with Matthew too. Matthew was the oppressor, not the oppressed.
Well, Matthew was welcomed into the community
Matthew
of the oppressed.
Right.
converted.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I just mean that he's somebody who got into the, from the oppressor into the oppressed. He entered the discipleship group.
That's right. You see, and following Jesus means that you no longer identify with the oppressor. You reject him. You know, that's what Jim Cohn said, you know. You reject him. You take up your cross and you follow him. You know, now where is he? Where is he going? Following him is like going through a giant maze where streets intersect. You know, where the jagged edges of buildings are going up and coming down, you know, and where the ceaseless movement of men and machine and noise and dust is. You know, that's where he is. Because that's where the oppressed live.
Church funds for inner city ministry, and how we normally lose the battle at conventions.
Always. Check out all the other items on any budget and see what's low on the totem pole. And, you know, it's strange that they can talk about sweet Jesus and stuff like this. It's really strange.
You know, your whole attitude towards the white people. Somewhat analogous to the attitude of the Bolsheviks to all non-Bolsheviks during the Revolution. No matter how reasonable these non-Bolsheviks were, and who supposedly saw a little light and necessity for reform and everything, nevertheless the Bolsheviks felt they were tainted with corruption of the czars and the Russian Orthodox Church and that kind of stuff, that they thought they had to root it out completely. And they didn't want any more parliamentary government, as good as that sounded, or anything like that. They didn't want any of the system left whatsoever. They felt there was absolutely no hope for reconstructing any system on the basis of the old, that involved any trace of the old system left in it.
You could really get in trouble with that statement, you know. So
well,
I'm going to do you the kindness of ignoring that statement.
Could I not ignore it?
You do whatever you want to do.
I mean, I think that there is a real judgment which recognizes where the demonic divides from the authentically human community, and that's the church world distinction. And that kind of judgment is what we're making. But that's a kind of a shifting line. You have to constantly remake that judgment. You know, it doesn't stay in the same place.
Man, do you know that I wouldn't be caught dead around the fireplace with you if your definition of me were the way you define me?
No, I'm just saying that.
You know, I mean, if you talk about, you know, you talk about my attitude, you know, and you compare me with the Bolshevik thing, you know, and I'm not so sure you're describing the Bolshevik thing accurately, you know. I think you're getting at something else, you know, maybe white guilt, maybe something else, you know. But man, the very fact that I'm here ought to be saying something to you. You see. You know,
right. Well, I'm just
what I am at this point, where I am, ought to be saying something to you.
Well, it does, but I'm just saying that these centuries of oppression and everything build up this feeling that the whole system has to be rooted out.
Well, I agree. That's true. It's got to be rooted out. It's got to be changed.
Yes.
You know, the devil has got to die.
Yes.
But look, you know, remember what happened when Moses took the children out of Egypt. Remember, the generation had to die.
That's right, exactly.
Well, you know, I think this is, you know, this is true, and this is exactly what Willie said. You, there just isn't any way out. We have to die to this, you know. If we don't die physically, you know, we're fortunate, but I mean, if we have to die the other way.
Yes.
Because we still smell. I just say, you know, there isn't a common humanity smell to us.
You know, I mean, you know, if you were really, like, you know, genuine, you know, I mean, and if you were ready, I mean, if you were all converted, you know, then I think that the complexion of this crowd would be different, you know. Carol said it, you know, 50-50 and stuff, you know. You would understand some things about the land you're on, you know. You would be moving against, you know, that which oppresses, dehumanizes, systematically disenfranchises people, you see. My question is whether or not, you know, you can understand the role of a man who at this point is a missionary. He's not, you know, he's not quite ready to burn down your idol yet, you know, because, you know, I mean, some of it's good, you know, let's face it, you know. I admit that all the time. Some of my best friends are white people. You know, all I'm trying to say is that, you know, don't you dare try and analyze me or my attitude. You know, you let me do that if I choose to do it at this point. You know, you shut up and take orders from me, and you ask questions for information and nothing else. Now, at the same time, that gives you the right to argue with me. I don't want to deny you that, you know. But let's not have any stupid arguments.
And your point that we should value the fact of your presence here works the other way around. We're here too. You should be valuing the fact of our presence here and not saying that it's at a zero point.
We're not at a zero point that
we won't do anything about this problem and need something done about it. If we're listening to you, then we're starting, right? But we're starting, right? We're here listening to you. We're not zero, we're one at least.
So you didn't come here to find him, or
she
came here to find him.
Well, he was
coming.
I came here to find what God
had.
Yeah. I mean,
we
did give kind of
public
people, so a few people
might have. Anyway, I sort of try to say about you make a judgment where the demonic divides from the authentically human, but that's a moving line. You see, you have to constantly remake that judgment. And what tends to constantly happen is that people try to institutionalize that line.
Yeah.
And then say, we've got the good and that group is the bad, and Jesus moves on and leaves that line and moves someplace else, you see. And so what was in Marx an authentic dividing line between the demonic and the authentic community, namely the oppressed community against the oppressor, becomes in the Bolsheviks, you know, institutionalized. And of course the church did the same thing. So that's what we got to kind of fight against, this effort to institutionalize where the good people are, because as soon as that happens, the good people aren't there anymore.
I think of one example from last year in the same setting, when we were arguing pretty much the same issue, and Elmer was sitting in the seat that Willie occupies, and one of our laymen, who was very much with this place, a fine Presbyterian layman, was arguing with Elmer because he was on a high-rise committee. He says, I won't win, I can't make it, I won't change anything, all you're asking me for is suicide. And, you know, Elmer says, that's right, death. Well, he went back and he went through the death, and he had to resign from all these, you know, status things down in Santa Monica, and it was death. And then he wrote a tremendous poem, and when the death came, it was really great, triumphing that at least the issue had been made, and they could never forget the issue, even though he couldn't win open housing in this expensive high-rise for retired people.
Yeah, you see, right, you know, it goes without saying that the price of admission into the black condition, you know, gets you killed. There's no question about it, you know. And you can't rationalize it or explain it away. That's the way it is. You know? That's the way it is. I know. I haven't always been black. But you see, you know, this fear of crossing over is the thing that gets us into these discussions, you know? The fear of going on home. That's the thing that gets us into these discussions. And this is the thing that really, really, really says, well, you know, Jesus ain't over there. Banker. First vice president of a bank, could not withdraw from the Olympic Club because he would have lost the mortgage, lost his house and his swimming pool and his car and probably his wife, who had become too used to those things. You see, he could not do that. He could not accept the call of Jesus.
Like the rich young man.
Like the rich young man.